It's the third hour first up here on TSN 1050. AK and Coco with you. We've got a jam-packed list of guests coming your way on the program. Buster only in less than 15 minutes. Talk about the Jays and Kevin Gausman's outstanding performance yesterday down at the Dome. A crucial performance on the mound for Gausman.
Much-needed win.
Much-needed win and much-needed rest for Toronto's bullpen, who had taken a beating over the previous 2 days simply because Kikuchi and Berríos were brutal against Milwaukee on Saturday and Sunday. So the Jays needed a stopper, and they got it with Gausman. We'll talk to Buster about that and potential moves the Jays could be looking to make. They do sign Sergio Romo, who was good like 10 years ago. Now, not so much. He's 39 years old. I think we need to temper any and all expectations for him, but clearly the Jays looking for more help with regards to their pitching, and I'm sure Buster has his ear to the ground on that. James Herbert from CBS on the Kyrie Irving story. He opts in. He's back with Brooklyn for now. In theory, he could still be traded by the Nets, and that really wouldn't shock me if that was the case. But as of now, the big three is back in Brooklyn. Kyrie, Durant, and Ben Simmons.
Yeah,
two
the
of
Brooklyn
the three,
Pigeons.
The Brooklyn Pigeons. And we're still working on our all-pigeon team in the NBA. I know you have LeBron on yours. You're not a fan of LBJ. Would Anthony Davis be on your all-pigeon team?
No. Lonzo Ball.
Street clothes? Oh, yeah. Lonzo Ball. Lonzo is the starting
Ball.
Point guard.
Yes.
For
definitely
your
starting all-pigeon team.
How about Goran Dragic?
You are a hater.
Goran Dragic is a pigeon.
But why, though?
Well, he kind of chirped Toronto, and let's call him a pigeon.
I don't know. Pigeon. I'm not willing to go that far with Dragic.
Trying to think of some other pigeons. Oh, Draymond Green's a pigeon.
Draymond Green is a pigeon.
Although yes. I did watch some of the, I think it's called The Old Man and the Three. It's J.J. Redick's podcast with Tate Alter, I believe is his name, his co-host. And they did a live show yesterday in New York. So they had Stephen A. Smith come, and it was a collaboration with Draymond's podcast. I watched some of it. It was really good. Really entertaining stuff.
How about the beef between Draymond and Kendrick Perkins?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's real.
Perk went back at him, and he had to delete the tweet that he sent about it. And it's just like
the NBA and the media, because Perk played, you know, for a long time. Went up against Draymond many times. I think Perk's only like 37. You would think Kendrick Perkins is like 100 years old, considering. Right. But he's 37 years old. He's not an old man by any stretch, especially in NBA years. So it's funny how he's made his way, and Draymond's only a couple years younger. So imagine those guys battled it out over the years.
Would Pat Beverly be on the pigeon team?
Oh, for sure. For sure. 100%. So that's a lot of point guards in the pigeon team. And we'll fill out our roster, maybe debate it with James Herbert when he joins us. And 9:30, the big guest of the morning. Well, I think there's a number of big guests. Andrew Cogliano, Stanley Cup champion. And we have to ask Cogliano about what happened on the ice, the celebration that Nicholas Obey Kubel kind of dropped the cup, dented the cup. And we have some audio from Phil Pritchard, the keeper of the cup.
Mm-hmm.
And he addressed the dent and what ensued following that. Let's hear it, Chrissy.
Hey, guys, we're here at the Amalie Arena. The Avalanche just won the cup. I don't even know if they had it 5 minutes and there's a dent at the bottom already. Right in the middle of the team photo. But you know what? It's the third time the Avalanche have won it. I guess we have a little chat with them soon, and we'll go through the process of how we're going to prepare it and that. But the Stanley Cup Tour will go on.
Do you know if it's how many times it's been dented before?
Well, I guess it's a new record today. It's 5 minutes into the presentation. It's happened. So it's the first time it's ever happened on the ice.
I think that if Phil Pritchard wrote a book about his experiences as the keeper of the cup and some of the things he's seen the cup be involved in, be one of the best-selling books of all time. John Grisham wouldn't be able to hold a candle to Philip Pritchard.
No
and
kidding.
I don't know if he signed some like non-disclosure agreement.
Oh, there has to be.
But
well, you know that like when we went to the parties, that the Stanley Cup parties that we both attended, you can't touch the cup without him beside it,
like being around,
right.
Or him or his colleague,
whatever.
Right-hand man.
Whatever. Like,
yeah.
He's at every party. He has to have it in sight every time so that he sees what happens to it. And what Nicholas Obey-Kubel did was just hysterical. Absolutely hysterical. It almost makes you wonder that because he's a guy that didn't play in that game, if he was already pre-drinking in the third period.
Interesting. Because, but, I mean, it was a close game. It could have gone either way.
Well, they had the lead going into the third period. True. So, they're you know like in baseball or in the NBA, they're always setting up just in case. Well, maybe that's what they were doing. And he just like, okay, well, the beer's here. I'm going to have one. I'm not playing tonight. In the worst case scenario, we lose this game. At least I got a couple beers in me for the flight on the way
home. That's right. Maybe a little bit of Pink Whitney. Sip on the Pink Whitney. And
by the way, Steph Curry, big fan of
Pink Whitney. I saw that video. Steph Curry taking part in the Barstool Classic yesterday, the golf tournament that those guys host. Riggs and Trent were there. I love those guys. So you see that Trent video series where he's trying to break 90 now?
No way.
Well, he broke 100. He was working with John Tillery. John Tillery
is your buddy Gabe in that video?
No, Gabe has broken 90, although he is having a tough year on the course. But, yeah, Trent working a break 90, and, man, it's tough to watch. He's an abysmal putter. But, yeah, Steph Curry took part in that, which was exciting to see, no doubt. And the guy's a stick, is Steph Curry. Just a very, very nice swing show. So shout out to Steph Curry and I mean, we'll get James Herbert's thoughts on that again when he joins us at 8:45. But yeah, I think the big news, some of the other big news in the hockey world yesterday had to do with the Hockey Hall of Fame, where Alex Burrows, who will join us at 9 o'clock, two of his former teammates, two of his former line mates, Daniel and Henrik Sedin, they get in. So does Roberto Luongo. No surprise there. A little bit of a surprise with Daniel Alfredson. He gets
You're a
in.
Hater.
Well, like, I was just a little bit surprised. He gets in on his fifth opportunity. And with the Sedins in particular, and you would have played against Vancouver with the St. Louis Blues in the playoffs. Was Alex Burrows, when he scored that OT winner, was that to eliminate your St. Louis Blues?
That was in game four in overtime.
That was a sweep of the sweep. Blues for Vancouver.
He scored the OT winner that game.
Yeah, I'm sure probably assisted by the Sedin twins.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, he played on that line. Look, you know, like, it's his role is so relevant to today's game because for years we've been saying who can play alongside Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner? Who can play alongside McDavid and be that wingman that could literally make millions of dollars being that guy just benefiting playing with those good players? Well, Michael Bunting came in this year and showed that he's a guy that will probably get a nice pay raise in his next contract because he's showing he can play with those guys.
He's got some mouse burrows.
Look at Evander Kane.
Yeah.
Evander Kane, who's a write-off in the NHL, comes in, puts himself in a situation, plays beside McDavid. Now he's in line to get himself a nice big contract potentially again. So Alex Burrows was a guy that Vancouver was looking for someone to fit alongside the Sedin twins because the Sedin twins, where they changed the game of hockey. Like, you talk about the way teams run power plays nowadays with the drop pass, with the shot passes.
Yeah, that was Sedin's.
That was everything the Sedins created. And 5-on-5, they played the exact same way. And if you just look at the list of names that that the Vancouver Canucks have tried to play alongside those guys, Alex Burrows is the number one guy that benefited the most.
For sure.
And had the biggest impact because not only could he score goals, he was the guy doing the dirty work, going in to get the pucks and get those guys the pucks, get to the front of the net, help them create the offense. And man, did he play that role incredibly well.
How about this stat? So the Sedin twins are I guess, given Alex Burrows as their third, as their guy in their line. In 2009, Alain Vigneault brings Burrows to the Sedins. From that game, the first time he was united with them, to the end of the Alain Vigneault era in 2013, Alex Burrows scored 100 even-strength goals in 311 games. The only two players to score more even-strength goals over that four-year period were Alexander Ovechkin and Steven Stamkos.
Unbelievable.
That goes to show the impact that Alex Burrows had alongside the Sedins. I'm sure he speaks very highly of those guys, not only because of all the success he had playing with them, but apparently, and you can speak to this, what great dudes they were too. Just awesome guys the Sedin twins were, and I'm sure you hated playing against them. Well, I know you did because they were
the
awesome.
The Sedins?
Yeah.
I didn't hate playing against those guys because they didn't really make it tough on you to play on them. Like, they weren't, like, grinding you down and stuff like that.
You're chasing them all
around.
They
were just hard guys to play against because literally they knew exactly where each other were on the ice, and you were always trying to be one step ahead of them.
The telepathy.
Was impossible to do. Like, these guys would be in the corner, and they'd make a backhand pass to the front of the net to the other guy wide open. You're like, how the hell did that guy know he was there? That's how good the Sedin twins were. And, you know, a guy like Alec Burrows, you know, what you really admire about who he was and what he turned his career into. This guy played in the ECHL for 3 years before getting to the AHL playing for the Manitoba Moose. And it was the Manitoba Moose where he really started to make a name for himself. Played for Vigneault in Manitoba. So Manitoba knew what type of player that he was. Played alongside guys like Kessler and Bieksa, who, believe me, I played against those guys a ton too. And I played against the St. John's. And I hated playing against those guys. But Burrows was a guy that wasn't afraid to mix it up, knew exactly what his role was played, you know, in your face, play as that sort of shift disturber type of guy, mm-hmm. and played that role, like, masterfully well with the Sedin twins, which, again, you look at his career at the Canucks, he played, what, 11 seasons? 12, well, more than that. He played, 11 seasons with the Canucks, and racked up an incredible career. He scored 35 goals 1 year playing alongside those guys.
Mostly at even strength. I mean, it wasn't necessarily on the power play the entire time with Henrik and Daniel as well. So Alex Burrows will join us in about 45 minutes time. Of course, you remember him from his time in Vancouver. He's now an assistant with the Montreal Canadiens, and there's some questions to be asked about the situation in Montreal as they have the number one pick in next week's NHL entry draft. Our ESPN MLB insider, Buster Olney, standing by. What is he hearing on the Jays' pursuit of pitching? We'll ask him next. You don't want to overreact to a game in late June and its importance, but I think for the Toronto Blue Jays, last night's game was significant. Following the two pitching performances they got on Saturday and Sunday from Yusei Kikuchi and Jose Berríos, neither of which were any good, neither of whom finished three innings, and the bullpen was taxed. The Jays needed a stopper, and that's exactly what they got from Kevin Gausman yesterday, who was facing a team in the Boston Red Sox who had reeled off seven wins in a row. They were humming, and Kevin Gausman was mowing them down yesterday. 10 strikeouts over seven shutout innings, a huge start for the Jays. And they pick up a 7-2 win over the rival Red Sox. They're back in action tonight with Ross Stripling, opposed by Michael Wacha. And let's welcome him in. It's our ESPN MLB insider, Buster Olney. Hey, Buster, what's going on?
What's going on? Yeah, watching that start last night, you know, reminded me of a conversation we had over the weekend with Dodgers manager Dave Roberts when he talked about, you know, how you have a young pitcher, and eventually, as they develop, at some point, they begin to understand, you know, how much is needed from them, how much is expected. And certainly Kevin, with all of his experience in the big leagues, he's signing the free agent contract. You know, he comes to the Jays knowing that there are going to be situations where they're going to look at him and say, look, we need you. Like, we need you to you know, make sure you pitch deep into the game. And even if it's not going well, you absorb some innings. And he shuts them down. There's an extra value in that, and not everybody is capable of doing what he did last night.
And you think about Yusei Kikuchi, the role he was asked to take on to start the year. He was the Jays' number five starter, but they also gave him a three-year deal worth $36 million. And to put it mildly, he has been terrible in the month of June. How do you expect the Jays to handle Kikuchi going forward? I would be stunned personally if they gave him the start against Tampa later this week. Do you think we could see him in the bullpen? Maybe one of those phantom injured list stints, Buster? What do you make of the Kikuchi situation that the Jays are dealing with?
Well, yeah, and then, I mean, look, there's a long time to figure it out. Having known Ross for as long as I have, having known Mark for as long as I have, I think they'll err on the side of patience. And let's face it, when you give a guy a multi-year deal, you're not going to turn the page, you know, permanently halfway through the first season of that deal. That's just the way it goes. And they should take some heart in the fact that they're in a good place in the standings. So we talked about that last week. And again, I you know, without having talked to Ross specifically about Kikuchi, I can't give you a great answer on that. But it wouldn't surprise me if they do make an adjustment here, at least temporarily, to buy him some time to figure it out.
Buster, could the adjustment be with the addition of Sergio Romo that they acquired yesterday? I mean, here's a guy in his time in Tampa, I believe at the same time Charlie Montoya was there, was used as an opener for the Tampa Bay Rays. I mean, he's an older guy. You know, he's not having a great year pitching-wise, but what do you think that the addition of a guy like Sergio Romo can represent for the Blue Jays?
Yeah, he, to me, is a lottery ticket, right? Relievers go up and down all the time. All it takes is one adjustment, and they can find it. And, you know, this is someone who for years and years and years, you know, has thrown about 45% sliders. He's like Adam Ottavino of the Red Sox, where he's going to throw slider after slider after slider. The problem for him this year, guys, has been on his two-seam fastball. He's gotten absolutely destroyed. 102 sinkers so far this year. Opponents have a slugging percentage of over 800 against him. But that's something, you know, at age 39, you will see guys, you know, maybe change a grip, maybe change the way they use a percentage of pitches. It surprised me this year to see how much more he's thrown his fastball, because typically he's always been a very slider-heavy guy. And I wonder if that's the beginning of the first conversation the Blue Jays have with him, to say, look, you've always been a guy who relies on your slider. You can wear down opposing batters and their patience throwing that pitch. Let's go back to doing that again. You know, given the fact that he's 39, given the fact that his ERA is almost 9 for this year, I'm sure that they're open-eyed to the possibility that he's, you know, might be nearing the end of his career. But, hey, why not? You know, if somebody else is paying the freight on him because he got released, then you might as well give him a shot.
The Jays playing host to the Boston Red Sox, Buster, who have been red hot, previously having won 7 in a row prior to last night's loss. But they're also at least on the verge of getting Chris Sale back. He is expected to make a rehab start with Portland this week. What type of boost do you think Chris Sale can give the Red Sox at this point in his career?
Absolutely a big one, because he's now, you know, a couple years removed from his Tommy John surgery. And when he's thrown to hitters during the course of his rehab this year, he's looked so much better than he did last year. When he came back from his Tommy John surgery the first time, he didn't have full command. He was essentially reduced to a two-pitch pitcher, fastball, slider. And now he's throwing his changeup as well. You know, we've seen, you know, how great he can be in the past. And that's the guy the Red Sox need him to be, especially since he's right in the middle of this $145 million contract. He seems capable of it. You know, I am really, really curious about the conversations within the Red Sox organization as we look ahead, you know, to how this season could play out. Because as you guys know, like, their second to last series for the Red Sox is in Toronto, you know, and there's no reason to expect that the vaccine mandate is not going to be, the rules aren't going to change before we get to that point. There appears to be a real chance that the Red Sox and Blue Jays are going to face each other in the first round of the playoffs, because they're going to be the number one and number two wild card seeds, you know, if they continue to play well and they don't make up the huge ground behind the Yankees. And if the Blue Jays finish with the best wild card record, that would mean they would host that series. And that would mean Chris Sale, as important as he is, as good as he could be, you know, if he's still unvaccinated by then, oh my goodness, you talk about a conversation. Wow. Going into that series. I'm going to be really interested to see how that plays out. We're already seeing it now with Tanner Houck. Jaron Duran, who's been so good for the Red Sox so far this year, not available to them. They're at a competitive disadvantage. There's no question about it. And you know what? Tough. Players have to start making some adjustments here, as they have with the Blue Jays, Yankees, and other teams.
Right, right. Well, speaking of tough, there was a brawl in baseball on the weekend. And, you know, everybody loves a little brouhaha or a little scuffle, but this was full-out brawl. We saw some suspensions come down yesterday as the manager for the Angels, Phil Nevin, got 10 games. It's probably, you know, deserving considering, you know, how he manipulated this whole situation by starting a bullpen pitcher to go out and basically ding the first two batters that he faced. What did you make of the fallout of what you witnessed in the brawl and the suspension that came down with it?
Yeah, here's the great thing about Phil Nevin, who I've known for a long time. He's really honest. And here's the bad thing about Phil Nevin. He's really honest. Right? In his game the other day, after, you know, a couple pitches were thrown near the head of Trout, Nev was completely transparent in his reaction. You know, as the Mariners are celebrating on the field, he's pointing at his head, screaming at Scott Servais, the manager of the Mariners. And I'm sure that was probably on the front burner for Major League Baseball officials as they determined what Nev's suspension was going to be like. This was, it appears by all, you know, evidence that we have, completely premeditated, the whole thing. You know, the reaction after Trout was nearly hit in the head, as you say, you know, changing his situation so that he puts in an opener. To have the opener now, people are reading lips. I think John Boy has it on his website. The guy saying to Jesse Winker, one of the batters that he threw at, "Hey, sorry, you know I had to do what I had to do."
Wow.
I mean, it's not a good situation. And as I say, I love Nev. I love the fact that he's getting a chance to be a manager in the big leagues. But think about this. At the outset of his managerial career, something he's waited on for so long, at the end of 28 games, he'll have actually managed 18 and served suspension in 10 others. Might want to dial it back a little bit.
Maybe just a little bit. Buster Olney, our guest from ESPN. Let's talk about the Yankees, the weekend they had where they went 16 and a third hitless, and they ultimately win the game on Sunday. Aaron Judge, lo and behold, another huge performance and a big comeback win last night for the Yanks against the Oakland A's. But Aaron Judge, and we've talked so much about him so far this Major League season, on pace for 60 home runs or so. What do you think that means for baseball, Buster?
Yeah, he's on pace as of this morning for 61 homers. And look, we all remember when Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa in 1998 were going for the Roger Maris mark of 61 homers. And we also know that, you know, subsequently that number became tarnished. I mean, I'm on record with you guys. I voted for Bonds. I voted for McGwire for the Hall of Fame, voted for Sosa. But there are a lot of baseball fans who don't consider the single-season home run record. First, it was McGwire at 70, and Barry Bonds broke his record in 2001 by hitting 73. A lot of baseball fans don't consider that to be a legitimate record because the ties to PED. If we get into August and September and Judge has a chance to hit 60, that is going to take over the sport. You will see all of his plate appearances you know, on SportsCenter, on ESPN. People will be breaking in wondering, you know, did Aaron Judge hit another one? Did he do it again? And all of it, of course, as we've talked about, is at a time when he is just building his own case for free agency in the fall. It is a remarkable series of events coming together for him, and I'm sure that there's going to be an owner of another team watching all of this and will be completely inspired in terms of taking a run at him. And, you know, people have talked about Judge being a guy who's injury-prone. He's played in 93% of the Yankees games since the start of the 2021 season. So that injury history now might just be part of his past.
And I guess the last guy who was chasing 60 would have been Giancarlo Stanton, now Judge's teammate, who finished with, 59, I believe? So he didn't quite get there, but it's been a long time since someone hit 60. Would have been back when Sosa and McGwire were doing it in the late 90s, or it's Barry Bonds, of course, in the early 2000s. Buster, as always, you're the man. We appreciate your time, and we'll chat with you next week.
Thanks, guys.
All right, that's Buster Olney. Ah, man, I think back to those Sosa, McGwire. 98, and it's funny, we talked about Evander Holyfield, Mike Tyson, the biting of the year, and 25-year anniversary today of that incident, and the love affair I had with the McGwire Sosa home run chase back in 1998. I remember every morning waking up, I would have been like 8, 9 years old or whatever,
And running downstairs, I'm like, Dad, did Sosa require a home run? He's like, yeah. And I was like, sweet, let's go. I was so fired up. And then Barry Bonds,
a couple of years later,
73 homers. And it's interesting. I never really thought about how Aaron Judge, if he gets over 60, again, that's been done so rarely. And Giancarlo back in 2017 did have 59. And Judge, if he were to get 60, wouldn't that be something? That would be a remarkable accomplishment. Talk about timing. Cha-ching!
Yeah, no kidding.
Good job by him.
Paid that man his money. Yeah,
well, Kyrie Irving got paid yesterday. Opts in. $37 million player option for 1 year. We'll see what that lends itself to. His future in Brooklyn. Could he still get traded? I suppose that remains a possibility. We'll ask James Herbert from CBS about that in about 15 minutes' time as Hour 3 of First Up continues next. Paul tweeting in 10:50:50 how he used to impersonate the Mark McGwire batting stance. We were talking with Buster Olney about the glory days of the home run race in Major League Baseball. McGwire, Sosa in 1998, Barry Bonds in 2001 when he racks up 73 dingers in San Francisco. Many of them.
But wasn't that the norm? Like when those three guys were having their home run race, Sosa, McGriffey, and McGwire. Literally every kid that was playing baseball was replicating one of those three stances.
It's true. It's true. And I think McGwire, I love doing so. I was a huge Sosa fan. Number 21, my favorite number to this day because of Sammy Sosa.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah.
Corked bat and all.
Oh, absolutely. I still remember the corked bat, how devastated I was. I had him on my fantasy team. He was so good that year. And it was in Milwaukee. And I remember one of my buddies called me. My buddy Ricky was like, hey, you seeing Sammy Sosa as a corked bat? Busted. Yeah. I'm like, oh, no. Oh, not Sammy Sosa, but you're right. I mean, it was those stances, and it was Tony Bautista.
Oh, Tony Bautista.
Tony Bautista.
The open stance?
Yeah.
The old, like, the soft grip on the hands? Or no, was it the soft grip, or was it just the...
No, it was just really very wide open stance. It was very, like, it was crazy.
Yeah, but the bat was the bat on his shoulder, or was it up?
No, it was on his shoulder.
Yeah, so it was the soft grip on the bat.
The batting stance that I always like to do in, like, you know, Little League was Gary Sheffield.
With
bat waggle?
The bat waggle?
Gary Sheffield.
What about Craig Council?
Oh, Craig Council's a good one,
too. Where he'd just sit there, and he'd literally, like, he'd hold his bicep so close to his face where you could only see his eyes. And I'm like, how does this guy hit in the major leagues like this?
So text us 10:50:50 with your favorite batting stances. But I think Sheffield is my go-to.
Sheffield is a tough one, though, because you think about it, like, you're trying to concentrate on a 100-mile-an-hour fastball coming at you, and you're waggling your bat 100 miles an hour in your hands. That's a tough one, man.
And he could just turn on anything.
Oh, he would just turn on
crush
anything.
Crush it out of the yard. So shout out to Gary Sheffield. Big fans of
batting stances. That's a good one, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, you are a legend of the Oakville community with Woodbridge, you know, with some of your dominance in softball.
Woodbridge softball, not Oakville softball.
Woodbridge softball.
Yeah.
Was Andrew Cogliano any of your opponents over those years?
No, he didn't play. Yeah, no.
He's scared.
I don't even know if he played.
Everyone
softball.
Played softball at some point, no? Especially if you're like an NHL guy. They all played softball.
And probably.
It's softball season right now. I kind of miss it, man. I've retired from softball.
A friend texted in, Mickey Tettleton.
Okay, wow. Phillies back in the day.
Right.
Yeah. Wow, that's a callback.
That's a big
time. That's
the
90s.
Julio Franco.
Oh, Julio Franco for sure. He might still be playing. He's like 80 years old. That guy played until he's like mid-40s with Atlanta.
Right.
And yeah, those are some good ones for sure.
Who is the leadoff guy for the Jays? It wasn't Devon White.
Otis Nixon?
Otis Nixon.
Yeah.
Yes. He had a good one too. Troy Gloss. Wow, we could go on and
Joey
on.
Bats, too. No
Joey
doubt,
Bats.
No doubt. So, yeah, Texas 10:50:50 if you have any favorite of your batting stances over the history of Major League Baseball. There's a long, long,
long list.
No doubt. James Herbert will join us on the other side. He covers the NBA for CBS, and he's been all over this Kyrie Irving situation, which, at least for now, has reached a conclusion. He opts in to his $37 million player option, and he issues a quote to Shams Charania, "Normal people keep the world going, but those who dare to be different lead us into tomorrow." And I guess Kyrie Irving dares to be different, and he leads us into tomorrow. I suppose that's what he is implying here, but in any case, Kyrie, Kevin Durant, Ben Simmons, That's the big three in Brooklyn. If you had to lay it out right now, where would you have Brooklyn ranked amongst your favorites in the Eastern Conference? You'd have Milwaukee ahead of them, right?
Yeah.
You'd probably have Boston.
Boston for sure.
Could see Brooklyn sliding in
Milwaukee.
Number three.
I would put the Miami Heat there too. I mean, they're not losing anybody in their roster, are they?
Yeah, I guess you could make that argument depending on how Kyle Lowry comes back. Maybe Philly.
Harden, no, I'm not buying
Embiid.
Philly, man. James Harden is going to be the same problem that Kyrie Irving is. It's just like James Harden will play games because he plays basketball, but he has lost a massive step playing basketball.
It looks like it. Offensively, he's not nearly
massive step. Unless this guy comes in and comes in and he's 50 pounds lighter.
50 pounds lighter.
It's being sarcastic.
Yeah, okay.
But this guy needs to recognize that the older he gets, the better shape he needs to be in to play.
I was thinking about, because before this Kyrie situation had resolved itself, there were also rumors that Kevin Durant could be on the move. And I was thinking, what if the Raptors get traded for Kevin Durant? And let's say the salary cap didn't exist in the NBA, and it does. So this would not have been a possibility. Would you have traded Scotty Barnes for Kevin Durant straight up?
No.
You'd have Durant, Siakam, Van Vliet as your big three? For the next couple of years, undeniably, you're one of the top NBA title contenders.
I
love Scotty Barnes.
I think there's too much upside with Scotty Barnes.
I agree.
To maybe hope for 3 years out of Kevin Durant.
You know what's going into year 16, Kevin Durant? 16.
And you just think about, if the Raptors were a Kawhi Leonard piece away.
Well, that's what Durant would represent.
No, he wouldn't.
What do you mean?
If the Raptors trade for Kevin Durant and they give up Scottie Barnes, they're instantly NBA contenders for the championship?
Absolutely.
With what around him?
Well, Siakam's an all-NBA player.
Siakam and Van Vliet.
Gary Trent. Yeah, that's pretty good.
I'm not
saying it's as good as the 2019
team. That's what I'm saying.
Again,
that's what I'm comparing it to.
And that deal would never happen. I was just speaking hypothetically.
I know you are, and I'm speaking hypothetically too. What I'm saying is that if you make that trade, I don't automatically legitimize the Raptors of being NBA contenders, because when Kawhi Leonard came over, the Raptors had the pieces around him, and the Gasol trade put him over the top, but they had the pieces around him ready to win. I don't think the Raptors have that if you eliminate Scottie Barnes out of the lineup and you bring in Kevin Durant.
Durant's pretty damn good.
I'm not denying that. I'm just saying there's still more.
Oh, well, yeah, man, dude, you go back to 2019, Van Vliet, Norm Powell, and Serge Ibaka were coming
extras.
Off the bench.
Yes.
They were coming off the bench. The depth of that team was nuts.
Barely coming off the bench. Remember in the playoffs, you were like, no, stay on the bench.
Well, for some of that playoffs for Van Vliet, that was the case. And then he had his kid, and the rest is history. So, what a time that was. So we'll get James Herbert's thoughts on what the Kyrie situation means. And DeJounte Murray of the Spurs is heavily rumored to be on the move as well. That kid is a superstar in the making. I have no idea why.
I'd be lining up for him
if
he had a chance.
He's awesome. So he could be on the move, and we'll get his thoughts on the entire realm of the NBA with free agency coming up.
By the way, another name thrown at us for the batting stance, Kevin Youkilis.
Yeah, Al's brother texted me that. Did he text that to you as well?
No, somebody tweeted it.
Oh, yeah, Al's brother.
Kevin Youkilis, that might have been the worst.
The Greek
that might have been the worst baseball stance I've ever seen.
Effective player and great goatee in the line of Pierre LeBrun. James Herbert coming up in about 6 minutes time, plus Alex Burrows at 9 a.m. Andrew Cogliano, Stanley Cup champion, coming your way in 45 minutes. Don't even think about changing that dial. You're listening to TSN 1050. Empire State of Mind, and I guess Kyrie Irving has the Empire State of Mind still deep in his mind, amongst other things, as he opts in for this coming season, $37 million. There were some rumors percolating that Kyrie was going to opt out, sign with the Lakers, and take a $30 million pay cut, but that is not the case. To discuss that and many things around the NBA, we welcome in James Herbert from CBS Sports. What's up, James?
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure as always, my man. So let me ask you, what was your level of surprise when you saw the Shams Charania tweet that Kyrie was indeed opting in for this season?
I think I was probably more surprised with all of the other tweets that happened earlier in the day, just about him, you know, being willing to consider the mid-level exception with, you know, with the idea that it was getting more likely that he might go to the Lakers. Like, to me, like, following this story the entire time, it always seemed like the most likely scenario was that Irving would return to the Nets on some kind of short-term deal, whether it meant just picking up this option and letting things play out, or whether it meant opting out and re-signing for, you know, like 2 or 3 years rather than the full 5. Maybe if he sort of, quote-unquote, won the negotiation, he'd be able to get 4 out of them or be able to get some sort of unconventional contract where the Nets would have outs if he missed a certain number of games or what have you. But it always seemed like the two sides really needed each other. It just seemed like there was a lot of posturing going on both ends of this, right? Because the Nets want Kyrie Irving on their team. They just don't want to commit to him on the full 5 years, like $250 million after what he kind of put the franchise through. And on Irving's end, it's like he said, you know, after the season, he did not want to leave Kevin Durant. He did not plan on going anywhere, but he knew the deal and had to try to get leverage, had to try to make it seem like he was going to leave because he did want the full 5 years. He did want the $250 million. So that part of it made sense. It landed in a place that made sense to me. It was just like the road we took to get there was very strange. Like, I did not anticipate that we'd be having serious discussions about Kyrie Irving playing for $6 million next year. Like, that is, that would have been an extremely unusual outcome, but it ends up being somewhat believable because, like, a lot of unusual stuff has happened with Kyrie Irving over the past few years.
Well, and that's what makes this so outrageous with everything that's happened over the last, 7 to 10 days in the Kyrie Irving situation. I think, to be honest with you, and maybe you can tell me if you feel differently, I think he tried to take a stance on his importance on his team and in the league, and probably recognized that maybe the way he feels about himself isn't the way everybody else in the NBA feels about him, and that's why he just decided to go back and take the $37.5 million and commit himself to Kevin Durant, which is what he originally did in the beginning. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I mean, all of the reporting indicates, and I don't think this should be super surprising either, that there were not a bunch of teams lining up to give up a lot of assets to get in the Kyrie Irving business. There were not a lot of teams lining up to commit to him. Like, yes, Kyrie Irving, we will give you the most money in the most years that we are allowed to. Like, the Nets, if there were a situation where they could have traded him and gotten back a player of equal value or gotten back a combination of players and picks of equal value, like, I am sure they would have considered it. But if you just look at what he gives you on the court versus everything else, like, he probably has about the lowest trade value that you could imagine for somebody that talented. So I don't think it would have made a lot of sense if the Nets did have any way of bringing him back for him to have traded him for anything they could have gotten. Like, sure, the Lakers had interest in Kyrie Irving. Like, you show me a way they can get him on their team that does not involve Kyrie taking $6 million and that does not involve them sending, like, Russell Westbrook and a couple of firsts to the Nets. Like, it's not really possible the way that roster is constructed right now. And Brooklyn has no reason to do a trade like that, right? Okay. Like, that would make them significantly worse. That's just not going to be appealing. And I think Kyrie Irving thought that, you know, regardless of how he got there, there would be a team. Maybe there would be two teams. There would be options for him. There'd be a way for him to say to the Nets, if you don't give me what I want, then I will be able to go here and get what I want from this place. But there did not. I mean, at least according to all the reporting, there has not been a team that has stepped up and said, we're going to clear the salary cap space necessary to go and max you out. And on the other side, there's not been a team that has stepped up and given the Nets an offer that would have made sense on their end. So that left Kyrie with this looking like the best way to go forward. And I should say, like, there is still a chance for Kyrie Irving to end up on another team at some point. And there's also still a chance for Kyrie Irving to extend
with the Nets. Like, he has a full year before the start of the next offseason where they can offer him a contract extension and he can sign it, and they can also trade him wherever they want. He has no say in the matter as far as trades go at this point.
James Herbert is our guest from CBS Sports. Let's talk about the Nets as a whole. They have Kyrie. We believe Kyrie's coming back for at least one more year. Kevin Durant still on the roster, entering his year 16 season. And Ben Simmons is there, too. I mean, a lot of drama surrounding the Nets. Are you a believer in their roster construction?
Yes, with a caveat that we don't know exactly what the rest of the roster is going to look like. They don't have a ton of people under contract right now. They don't really have any big men under contract right now, aside from De'Ron Sharp, a rookie who didn't play all that much last year. So, you know, I want to see, like, does Patty Mills pick up his option? If he does, are he and Seth Curry both on the team next season? It would sort of surprise me if those two guys were both on the roster at the end of the season, but they're really good players, and we'll see what happens there. But I think the Nets need to find a way to be a little bit more balanced. They need to be a more athletic and versatile team than they were next year. Some of that will happen without them doing anything, just because they're going to get Ben Simmons, we assume. They're going to get a healthy Joe Harris, we assume, and automatically there. That's a lot more size you're adding to the equation. That's a couple of two-way players that you're adding to the equation. You just saw last year a super talented team that didn't have any sort of continuity and just had some, like, giant holes on the roster because two of their best four players were not available to them for either the entire season or significant parts of it, and it was not enough. But you still saw it. Like, against that amazing Boston defense in the playoffs, you can go look at the numbers. Like, the Nets offense was, like, a lot better than some of the other teams that they played that finished with better regular season records than the Nets did. There's a lot of firepower there. I think if they can just have a more normal season, if they can be somewhat healthy, it's not like they need Kyrie to play all 82. It's not like they need KD to play all 82, but if they can just get away from all of this crazy drama and all of this uncertainty and just be a normal, very good basketball team, then yeah, like, we could be talking about them as contenders. I do believe in the top-end talent on the roster. I just kind of want to see how they fill it out.
James, the Phoenix Suns were the best team in the regular season. They were surprisingly bounced pretty early in the playoffs in the Western Conference, and they have DeAndre Ayton, former top pick in the NBA draft. Sounds like he's going to be on the move. Where do you think Ayton ends up? Because yesterday there was a lot of odds movement in Vegas with regards to his landing spot. I think it went from, like, 60-1 to 4-1 that he would end up on the Brooklyn Nets, and then Kyrie resigns. Yeah, it's weird. What do you make of the Ayton situation in Phoenix?
Yeah, I don't think he's going to end up in the Nets. I think that was kind of people getting ahead of themselves, anticipating Kyrie leaving and Kevin Durant asking for a trade, and then somehow there would be, like, you know, the Nets would end up with Ayton and Mikal Bridges and draft picks or what have you. Like, I think that was kind of what that was. And it doesn't look like anything like that is happening anymore. And I don't know exactly where he will land up. There aren't a ton of destinations that really make sense for Ayton, but I do think there will be a lot of interest in him. The Pistons were the ones everybody was talking about, you know, a few days ago, but coming out of the draft after they were able to, get Jalen Duren there, it seemed like that was sort of a cheaper solution to their center situation. You hear Atlanta, you hear Toronto, you hear Portland. These are teams that are not just coming up recently, but, like, for months in discussing potential destinations for DeAndre Ayton. You hear San Antonio as a team that, you know, actually has cap space and could want to add him to the roster, but you also hear, like, maybe the Spurs are looking at trading DeJounte Murray, and maybe the Spurs aren't that interested in winning next year. If they're going to, like, tank next season, why are they trying to get a proven player? Like, there's a lot of smoke going around right now. I think all in all, the situation, much like sort of the Kyrie thing, is, like, you hear all of these rumors, you hear all these different little bits of information that's, like, technically news, but the particulars of it have not changed that much with Ayton either, just like they didn't with Kyrie. The reality is the Suns cannot afford to lose him for nothing. The reality is that they don't want to give him the max. So Ayton's going to be in a position where he's going to have to search out an offer. Maybe it means he signs an offer sheet and then the Suns essentially have to match it and grit their teeth, even if they don't want to pay him that much, because it would just be disastrous for that organization as a championship contender to lose a player of his caliber. And then maybe down the line, they end up trading him, but at least you don't just lose that salary spot. At least you don't just lose that player for nothing. You still have a chance to make a deal down the road. If he just goes and gets an offer, not actually signing an offer sheet, well, then there are some options, right? Like, you can work out a sign and trade involving DeAndre Ayton, where you send him somewhere else, you get back maybe a player that is not quite as good as Ayton, but costs less, and maybe there are draft picks involved. Maybe they get some more flexibility, and they can find kind of figure things out that way. I think the Suns' kind of angle on this entire thing has been, well, DeAndre wants to be the star. He wants to play a bigger role. Like, for us, like, the way our team is built, like, he has been able to play a very confined role and excel in it. And by the way, when he's been out, we've had other guys that have come in and played the center position, yeah, given us, like, you know, 70% of what Ayton did, and we've still just kept winning. I don't know how that comports with the way their season ended, which was obviously extremely disappointing for everybody involved, and DeAndre Ayton specifically. Like, I don't know how much that has to do with the situation that they're in, but it certainly seems like these two sides are not, like, planning for a long future together at
does.
The moment.
It really
but
does.
I do think it can change. Like, I do think, once again, like, if he signs an offer sheet with another team, then Phoenix's hands are kind of tied. At that point, you sort of do have to just bring it back and figure it out.
It'll be really interesting to see how it all plays out. James, you'll be all over it. We appreciate the time, my friend. Take care.
Thank you for having me.
All right, James Herbert from CBS Sports. Alex Burrows coming up on the other side. Andrew Cogliano, Stanley Cup champion, a jam-packed 9 a.m. hour, and it's coming your way next.